The world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like you. I'm Gary Starbuck, pastor of Open Door Bible Church in Midtown Memphis, Tennessee, where I've served for the past 38 years. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. The man who exposed Planned Parenthood loses in a California court, but David DeLeiden is not giving up. I'll talk to his lawyer.
Also, what happens to those social media accounts, photos in the cloud, and the rest of your digital estate when you die? We'll talk about that. Plus, our classic book of the month for December.
I suspect that most of us get old without growing up, and that inside, every adult, sometimes not very far inside, is a bratty kid who wants everything his own way.
It's Tuesday, December 3rd. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Now here's Kent Covington with the news.
House Democrats are pressing on with their impeachment inquiry this week as the scene shifts to the Judiciary Committee. The panel will hold its first hearing tomorrow. The Trump administration on Monday blasted Democrats for holding the hearing as President Trump heads to London for a NATO summit. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called it an attempt to distract from the president's mission overseas.
These are some of our most important allies and partners in keeping the American people safe and secure. I regret that they've chosen to hold these hearings at the same time.
And the White House has informed the Judiciary panel that it will not participate in tomorrow's hearing. In a letter to Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler, White House counsel said in part, "We cannot fairly be expected to participate in a hearing while the witnesses are yet to be named, and while it remains unclear whether the Judiciary Committee will afford the president a fair process through additional hearings." Meantime, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on Monday led her own overseas mission, heading up a congressional delegation at a UN climate change conference in Madrid. While President Trump has made clear that the United States is pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, Pelosi delivered a different message.
"We're here to say to all of you, on behalf of the House of Representatives and the Congress of the United States, we're still in it."
She said climate change is a threat to public health, the economy, and national security, and that the Paris Agreement is vital to combating that change. The congressional group is separate from the official U.S. State Department delegation at the conference. The United States technically remains a member of the Paris Agreement until November 4th of next year, one day after the presidential election. A small town near the U.S.-Mexico border began cleaning up Monday, gripped by fear after a deadly weekend gun battle between drug cartels and security forces. World Radio's Anna Johansson reports.
On Saturday, armed men in a convoy of dozens of vehicles arrived in Villa Union and began shooting up City Hall. Many of the vehicles were emblazoned with the cartel's initials, CDN, for Cartel del Noreste, or Northeast Cartel. Security forces arrived within an hour and surrounded the town, about 35 miles southwest of Eagle Pass, Texas. Officials say 16 gunmen died, along with four state police officers and two civilians. On Monday morning, the town of about 6,000 people was littered with burned-out vehicles, and homes, churches, and government offices were riddled with bullet holes. The motive for the military-style attack is unclear. Just days before the shootout, President Trump announced plans to designate Mexican drug cartels as terrorist organizations. He hopes to launch operations against cartels inside Mexico. But the Mexican government says it cannot accept intervention from, quote, armed foreigners. Reporting for World Radio, I'm Anna Johansson.
China is retaliating over U.S. support for pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying announced Monday that China will suspend U.S. Navy stops in Hong Kong. The suspension will ban U.S. military ships and aircraft from visiting the territory. Last week, President Trump signed two laws sanctioning Hong Kong and Chinese officials for cracking down on pro-democracy protesters. Hua warned of further necessary actions if the United States does not change course. She also said China will sanction several U.S.-based rights groups that, quote, performed badly in the ongoing demonstrations in Hong Kong, including Freedom House and Human Rights Watch. Another church attack in Burkina Faso killed more than a dozen worshipers on Sunday. World Radio's Kristen Flavin has that story.
Worshippers gathered at a Protestant church in the town of Hontokoura when gunmen opened fire. The attackers killed at least 14 people and wounded many more. A source told AFP News that the victims include the church's pastor and multiple children. The president of the West African nation, Rochmark Christian Kabore, said Sunday that he condemned the barbaric attack, and he offered condolences to the victims and their families. Violence against Christians is on the rise in Burkina Faso. Suspected extremists have killed more than 500 people since last year and displaced nearly 500,000 others. Last month, at least 37 people died in an attack on a convoy carrying employees of a Canadian mining company. Reporting for World Radio, I'm Kristen Flavin.
Montana Governor Steve Bullock is dropping out of the presidential race. Bullock said on Monday that it was clear he would not be able to crack the top tier of Democratic candidates. His campaign had touted his crossover appeal to some center-right voters, arguing that he was the best bet to defeat President Trump. The governor was the only Democratic candidate to win in a state that Trump won in 2016, but his campaign never really gained traction. The two-term governor did not participate in any of the last three presidential debates after failing to reach the polling and fundraising numbers needed to qualify. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, pro-life activist David DeLeiden suffers a legal setback, plus accessing the digital assets of loved ones after they die. This is The World and Everything in It.
It is Tuesday, the 3rd of December, 2019. Glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Today is Giving Tuesday. Now, before we get started today, I do need to make a quick correction about yesterday's Monday Money Beat. When I reported on record-breaking retail sales totals for Thanksgiving and Black Friday, I left out a small word, small but very important, the word online, as in online sales, which of course stands to reason because these figures are estimates, and the only way to make quick and reasonably accurate estimates is to pull the only instant data available, and that would be the online data. So online sales broke records. Now, it'll be a while before we know the overall figures, but I think the overall figures are going to be enormous. If you look at the calendar year 2018, we set a record for retail sales in the whole year, $6 trillion, according to the Census Bureau. So sorry for that little imprecision, and I hope that fixes it.
Wow, those are staggering numbers. You know, I noticed in the news wires several stories about a sort of Black Friday backlash overseas, people boycotting stores and protesting what they see is harmful consumerism. And, you know, from a Christian perspective, you kind of want to resonate with that a little bit. Not specifically the protesters' message, they don't celebrate Thanksgiving, but there is something a bit unseemly about measuring solemn holidays like Thanksgiving by retail sales, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, sure. I don't necessarily disagree with that idea, and I say that as a proponent of free market economics. I am a committed Austrian. I resonate with free trade on terms that are mutually agreeable because in that way, you know, we meet our own needs and at the same time meet the needs of our neighbor. Now, that's the beauty of the free market, that it's not coercive, it's cooperative, it's win-win. And along those lines, I mentioned Giving Tuesday, and I'd like to suggest here that Giving Tuesday is a healthy addition to Black Friday and Cyber Monday. I love Christmas shopping because it should be about giving gifts to others, to our children, to friends and family. But in addition to your early Christmas shopping, Giving Tuesday is really a terrific day to remember your favorite charitable endeavors.
Well, it is. And this is a great kickoff to World's December Giving Drive. We'll be talking more about that in the coming days, about the importance of supporting sound journalism grounded in God's Word. World is a nonprofit, so that means your contributions qualify as tax deductible. And with a community of believers powering this journalistic team, we're making a difference by modeling biblical objectivity and recapturing a historic vision for sound journalism.
Yeah, and Giving Tuesday is a perfect starting point, I think. This little idea, Giving Tuesday, got its start back in 2012. It's grown, as of last year, to a $400 million day for all kinds of charities. 3.6 million people in our country participated last year. They gave a little more than $100 each on Giving Tuesday. So I did a little bit of figuring, looking at last year's Cyber Monday so that we could do an apples-to-apples comparison. 2018, Cyber Monday, $7.9 billion. Giving Tuesday 2018, $400 million, as I mentioned. So that works out to roughly 5%, just 5%. But when it's all counted, I think that this year we're going to see a Cyber Monday exceeding $9 billion. And if that is a bellwether of giving, then it should translate into $455 million for America's Giving Tuesday. And I hope it's more than that. You know, America continues to be the most charitable nation on earth, and we need to keep that title.
Yeah, I love that. And world movers are, in my view, the most charitable group in our most charitable nation. We don't have the specific stats to back this up, but we feel like it's safe to say world people aren't 5%ers. We're 10%ers. We're 15%ers. And you've been so generous in the past to support our work here, and we're counting on you to keep doing it.
Here's something that we do know statistically, that 90% of listeners to The World and Everything in It use mobile devices to listen. Three quarters of our listeners use iOS. And I'm happy to let you know that we have made mobile giving very, very easy, particularly if you're using an Apple product to listen. So if you visit wng.org/donate, you can make a Giving Tuesday gift right now via Apple Pay. And I really think that's a great platform because it does provide an extra layer of security at wng.org/donate, which is a secure site. Of course, we have several other easy options for you, and all of that is spelled out on the page at wng.org/donate.
So if you're thinking about participating in Giving Tuesday, I hope you'll remember your friends here at World and that you'll support sound journalism grounded in God's Word. Support us with a tax-deductible gift here on Giving Tuesday. It is a labor of love, what we do here every day. We love doing this, but it is also labor, and it takes a team of co-laborers to make all of it happen. So join our World Mover team, and you have our heartfelt thanks.
All right, well, let's get into the rest of our program, and we'll begin today with a legal setback for the pro-life movement. Let's go back 4 years. You may remember the name David Daleiden. He stunned the abortion industry with secretly recorded videos of candid conversations with Planned Parenthood executives. Daleiden made those recordings at an abortion industry conference he infiltrated by posing as a traitor in fetal tissue. In the videos, we see abortion providers talking about selling body parts of aborted babies and making a profit doing it.
Now, that's illegal under federal law, but Planned Parenthood escaped any penalty, in part by claiming Daleiden edited those videos in a deceptive way. Then the abortion giant went after Daleiden in court, claiming he violated federal racketeering laws to make those recordings. Last month, a California jury sided with Planned Parenthood and ordered Daleiden to pay more than $2 million in damages. Joining us now to talk about what's next is Peter Breen. He's an attorney with the Thomas More Society, and he represents David Daleiden. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. Thanks, Mary.
Well, Planned Parenthood sued David Daleiden under the federal RICO statutes. That's the racketeering-influenced corrupt organizations law. Can you explain in simple terms how Planned Parenthood made the case for a RICO violation?
Well, they used a rare part of RICO, a part that's not really used. They said the fact that he used a couple of novelty IDs brought this within RICO. The problem is that is the same thing any other undercover journalist who takes on a cover story. They use these novelty IDs on a regular basis. And so we think that's not going to hold up on appeal, but it is something that was the theory that they went in with to get treble damages, multi-million dollars, and attorney's fees, which would be millions of dollars on top of the actual damages themselves.
Well, your firm has defended against RICO charges and other pro-life matters, I believe. Another case your firm was involved in was called Now versus Shiler. Might that help in Daleiden's appeal from this jury verdict? And if so, how?
Right. And Now v. Shiler was probably it was the top pro-life case of the last 20 or 30 years until the David Dalyden cases. And that was to defend pro-life sidewalk activism. So sidewalk counselors and others who go to the abortion facilities. We were able to beat that in the Supreme Court, although, you know, we took a tough jury verdict in that case as well out of Chicago. But that case established very clearly that when you are not obtaining property, so anytime you're in an activist type situation where it's a boycott or what have you, you know, you're not trying to steal from the people you're boycotting or that you're picketing or protesting. You just want people to stop going to those businesses and you want them to shut down. It was the same thing that was being done here. No one stole anything, harmed anything, took anything. All they did was, like any other undercover journalist, you start the camera rolling, you get people engaged in conversation, and they are much more candid with you because they don't know they're being taped than they would be if they were, for instance, under subpoena or being represented by lawyers and what have you.
Well, sure. Well, this jury verdict obviously personally affects Dalyden a great deal. In a larger sense, though, if this verdict stands, what's at stake as far as legal protections for pro-lifers?
Well, this verdict has the potential to shut down any sort of undercover journalism against Planned Parenthood or other abortion providers. And that is extremely important, particularly in the blue states, where you've seen prosecutors look the other way repeatedly when abortion clinics have legal violations and what have you. The only people who are there to be able to ensure that these folks are following the law are undercover or some sort of surreptitious actors. You could shut all of that down if this jury verdict holds true. But even broader, and this is going to be one of our primary grounds for appeal, let's say your issue isn't abortion. Let's say it's animal rights. Let's say it's corrupt politicians. How are you going to do undercover journalism when you can't use a cover story, when you cannot use a novelty ID to get into a building so that you can get into a meeting with that, you know, that corrupt politician or the shady lawyer or whomever that needs to be investigated? There's really broad sweeping implications of this jury verdict.
Mm-hmm. Well, we should also note that this was a civil lawsuit, but Dalyden and Sandra Merritt, a fellow activist, still face criminal charges in California. Where does that case stand?
Well, on December 6th, we are going to hear whether that case is going to go to jury trial. There are 14 counts remaining. We were able to get one of the 15 counts thrown out already. But, you know, what we're trying to do is just slice off as many counts as we can because they're really not supported by the evidence. And that case is about the undercover taping law in California. You know, there's a decade at San Quentin at risk on those charges if we are unsuccessful. So we're gonna do everything humanly possible. The nice thing about that case is we are able to put in more full evidence than the federal judge in the civil case was allowing us to do, and that is something that will assist us in terms of showing the public good of what David and his colleagues did.
Peter Breen is an attorney with the Thomas More Society in Chicago. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's great to be with you, Mary. Thanks.
Additional support comes from Samaritan Ministries. Samaritan members have been sharing healthcare costs for the last 25 years and plan to for the next 25. More at SamaritanMinistries.org. From ChristianBook.com, everything Christian for less at ChristianBook.com. And from the liberal arts tradition, helping you discover what great education once was and can be again, LiberalArtsTradition.com.
Well, coming up next on The World and Everything in It, digital life after death. When you think about your estate, you probably think my house, my car, money, and my bank accounts. But what about digital assets?
Right, meaning electronic records on your computer, phone, or tablet. We're talking cryptocurrency, electronic bills, email, social media accounts. Most people know that they need a plan for their physical assets when they die, but few people prepare for distribution of digital assets. World Radio's Sarah Schweinsberg reports now on how that's changing.
This story originally appeared in our sister publication, World Magazine.
Celia Cross, her husband and grandson, were driving home from a family vacation when they got the call. Their 26-year-old son, Cameron, had died.
because of Cameron's faith in Jesus, we're confident that we will see him again and that he is in heaven with the Lord.
Before his death, Cameron hadn't made a will or designated an estate executor. That included access to his digital assets. Cameron's cell phone was password protected. And because he hadn't named his parents as executors, the phone company couldn't legally give them access. That meant the loss of a precious digital asset, photos.
If he had any stored anywhere, and even the ones on his phone, there's no way we can get to them.
Scott Magnuson is an estate lawyer in Pennsylvania. He says even if people do have a will, they often don't consider their digital assets, the Wild West of estate planning. Many people share passwords to their accounts with family members or executors. But unless they've given an executor written permission to access electronic records, the executor is essentially a hacker under federal law.
I'm sure that unknowingly there are people who are taking passwords, going online, and accessing things thinking that, well, this is what this person wanted me to do, and has no idea that technically they're violating the law.
Further complicating matters are terms of service agreements, or TOSAs. The agreements vary widely. Apple's iCloud TOSA says the company will delete data after a death. So does Yahoo's. Facebook allows users to memorialize pages. Google allows users to designate someone to have access to their accounts after death. That means even if an executor has been given permission to access digital assets, an individual TOSA could still get in the way. Recently, that happened to Scott Magnuson when a client made him estate executor. The client's email provider, TOSA, barred him from seeing her messages.
Under the terms of service, I wasn't designated as someone who had authority to access her, at least her email account.
There is hope that the rules governing digital assets could become more uniform and clear. 44 states have now passed the reformed Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act. Whew. Jerry Beyer is an estate expert at Texas Tech School of Law. He says the legislation automatically gives an executor power over digital assets like computer files, web domains, and virtual currency. But when it comes to written electronic communication like text messages and social media accounts, an executor still has to be explicitly named in a will or trust.
The way I look at it is it may not be the best, but it provides us with a framework.
Beyer says online companies will continue to be wary of giving out usernames and passwords until there's even more national uniformity surrounding digital assets.
Even though legally they could, they're afraid of liability. They're just afraid of revealing something wrong and they want protection.
In the meantime, lawyer Scott Magnuson says he's bringing up digital assets with most of his clients. And while there may not be clear answers surrounding electronic records, it's best to start asking the questions.
There are biblical provisions for caring for your family. That's part of loving your family, taking care of your family, and being a good steward of what the Lord has given to you.
Reporting for World Radio, I'm Sarah Schweinsberg.
Dog lovers understand how things can go awry sometimes, and usually it's not the dog's fault. Take Max, a black lab in Florida. In late November, his owner got out of his Mercury Sable with the engine running and shut the door with Max left inside. You can probably feel the foreboding. Max accidentally shifted into reverse, and that locked the door. He spent the next several minutes making backward circles in a cul-de-sac. Police arrived to figure out how to get the door open. Meanwhile, with Max at the wheel, a post box and a trash bin got taken out. Some quick footwork eventually let police enter a code into a keypad on the door and then take control of the car. For all the worry, nobody got hurt, and Max jumped out wagging his tail after his excellent adventure. It's the world and everything in it.
Today is Tuesday, December 3rd. Thank you for turning to World Radio to help start your day. Good morning. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Well, it is the first Tuesday of the month, and that means book reviewer Emily Witten joins us to talk about our classic book of the month. Emily, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Mary.
Well, Emily, I'm looking at my calendar, and it says Christmas is just 22 days away. Mm. How about a recommendation for a good book to give?
Well, I'll do you one better, Mary. I thought we could talk about two books today, specifically Two Calvins.
Two Calvins? Okay. I wonder if one of them might be John Calvin?
Oh, how'd you guess?
There's not that many Calvins.
That's true. And love him or hate him, John Calvin definitely ranks as one of the most influential thinkers of the Reformation. And some even argue his Institutes of the Christian Religion, first published in 1536, may be the most influential work in Western culture. But at over 1,000 pages of rich theology, it's admittedly a lot to bite off.
1,000 pages. Well, that sounds a bit ambitious to me, Emily. I mean, for a Christmas read, really?
Well, that's why I'm excited about a slim volume of Calvin's
okay.
called The Golden Booklet of the True Christian Life. And the book offers a concise look at how to live the Christian life, as the title says. It runs about 100 to 150 pages, depending on the translation.
All right, now we're talking. That sounds doable.
Well, it's a good place to start for sure. Calvin wrote the book's five chapters as part of his institutes, but he intended them to stand alone as well. He wanted people who weren't seminary students or pastors to read about practical Christian holiness. And Pastor Ligon Duncan explained the book's opening lines at a 2015 Ligonier Ministries conference.
Calvin says that the object of the work that God is doing in us to sanctify us, to conform us to Christ, to change us, to transform us, that the object is to manifest in the life of believers a harmony and an agreement between God's righteousness and their obedience.
Duncan goes on to explain that Calvin views holiness as an issue of family resemblance. So if you've ever seen a baby that looks like his father, he might have his father's eyes or his hair color. But just by looking at that baby, you know who the father is. And similarly, when people look at us, they ought to see something of God in us, and they ought to know we're his children.
Physical similarities versus behavior similarities. I like it. Mm. Well, what else makes the book a good gift?
Calvin swaps the typical flowery language of the Reformation with short bullet points. He also writes about our struggles in a realistic way, with chapter headings like self-denial and patience and cross-bearing. Pastor and author Burke Parsons helped translate one version with the title A Little Book on the Christian Life. And he noted in a 2018 Awakening conference that Calvin chose some interesting words to describe our Christian growth.
You hear this language of staggering and limping and crawling along on the ground. That's so often how sanctification feels, doesn't it? Calvin says our final hope is when we enter heaven's gates.
Calvin knows the Christian life isn't easy, but we press on because our ultimate hope cannot be shaken.
Well, that sounds like a good message for Christmas or really any season. Mm. Emily, who's the other Calvin you're recommending this month?
Well, hold on to your seat, Mary, because when I open this next book, at any moment, a tiger may pounce, monsters under the bed may attack. This book just screams danger.
Screams danger. Okay, I'm buckled up, ready to go.
Good, because in case you haven't guessed, I'm talking about Bill Watterson's comic strip, Calvin and Hobbes. Are you familiar with these guys, Mary?
Oh, yes. I've got the complete Calvin and Hobbes set. My father-in-law gave it to us for Christmas years ago.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that because our family has really appreciated these books, especially as Christmas presents over the years. And we like them enough that I asked my daughter, Anna, to read a strip for us. And so here's my 12-year-old reading from the essential Calvin and Hobbes.
What's for dinner?
Salmon.
Salmon? Blech.
Calvin, one of these days your face is going to freeze like that.
Wow.
Hi, Hobbs.
Good heavens, what's wrong with you? Mom said if I keep making this face, it'll freeze like this forever.
You really think so? It's worth a try.
I'll bet my features are hardening already. I always liked gargoyles.
Anna's a terrific reader.
No, oh, thank you. Well, I would have to say I agree, but I am a little biased.
Of course.
Yeah, so Bill Watterson started this comet back in 1985. It ran until 1995, and it grew out of another failed comet, the Doghouse. And yes, he named this Calvin after the other Calvin we've talked about today, believe it or not, Mary.
I didn't know that. So this Calvin is named after reformer John Calvin.
Exactly. Although, you know, we've talked about family resemblance. I don't see a lot of resemblance here. Calvin and Hobbes actually reminds me more of a Peanuts for a postmodern generation. And where Peanuts captures the 1950s culture, Calvin taps into the be-yourself relativistic thinking of the 1980s. Just the fact that a lot of the strip happens in Calvin's imagination. It's just kind of postmodern in that way. But for all that, he still resembles Charlie Brown in his relatability. You know, Calvin just seems like the kid next door. And here's a quote by Bill Watterson on that point. Simon Whistler reads it as part of a video series called Today I Found Out.
I suspect that most of us get old without growing up, and that inside, every adult, sometimes not very far inside, is a bratty kid who wants everything his own way. I use Calvin as an outlet for my immaturity, as a way to keep myself curious about the natural world, as a way to ridicule my own obsessions, and as a way to comment on human nature.
So in a kind of secular Screwtape Letters, Calvin and Hobbes here helps us see the sinfulness of our sin. And it's true that Watterson celebrates, quote, the subjective nature of reality, unquote. But he also skewers it. I mean, how often does Calvin jump off the roof, convinced that he can fly, and then wham, reality breaks in, you know? So in that right. way, the strip helps my kids see through a lot of the self-centered thinking, postmodern or otherwise, that they encounter in our culture. And as a parent, I really appreciate that.
Oh, I do too. Emily, thank you for these book recommendations today. Really useful.
You're very welcome, Mary. Happy reading and Merry Christmas.
That's right. 'Tis the season. Merry Christmas to you too. Today, Emily recommended The Golden Booklet of the True Christian Life by John Calvin, as well as The Essential Calvin and Hobbes by Bill Watterson. Find other classic book recommendations at worldandeverything.org. Just search for Classic Book of the Month.
Tomorrow, Washington Wednesday, we have news from Turkey and Syria, and we'll talk with World Senior Editor Mindy Bells about that. She's just back from a reporting trip there. And we'll meet a man who left a lucrative legal career to become a basketball coach. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. If anyone knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him, it's a sin. I hope you'll have a great rest of the day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.